Lecture 12, Acquiring and Maintaining Superstitions. Welcome back to the Science of Irrationality. We're going to continue on talking about superstition, and this time I'm going to talk about acquiring and maintaining superstitions. We don't know everything about this, but we do know some things about how people get acquire a superstition, adopt one, or more, and how we maintain them. So in the case of socially shared superstitions like black cats and lucky pennies and magpies, we get those superstitions from other people. Typically our families or others around us teach them to us, maybe when we're children, and we carry on that way. Personal superstitions, on the other hand, are thought to be a process of trial and error, where something happens that's either good or bad, and we make a connection between the two. And so we'll talk about a little bit about both. But the fact of the matter is that when it comes to socially shared superstitions, we don't know a whole lot about how that happens. I mean, some of it seems fairly obvious that it's picked up within your family. But beyond that, we don't know much. We do know that there are great differences in superstitions in various locations, which suggests a sort of cultural aspect to them. One example of that is the evil eye, which is one of the more widespread superstitions in the world. I'll talk to you more about that in greater depth later on. But the way in which the evil eye superstition plays out is quite different depending upon your location. And so we'll get into that. But what we do know about individual superstitions, personal superstitions, is a bit more extensive. And there are some classic studies that have taught us a little bit about this. One of the most famous studies of all is one that was done by B.F. Skinner, the American psychologist, who's associated with conditioning, operant conditioning, and behaviorism. He was the person who worked very extensively with this idea of learning from consequences, that if a good event happens following some action, that action will be repeated. And things that are rewarded become more likely to occur. So probably his most famous experiment of all time is one that was on superstition. He called it superstition in the pigeon. And he put the word superstition in quotes, recognizing that it's kind of odd to use the word superstition in regard to a pigeon. But maybe you'll understand when you hear more about the experiment. So it worked like this. He put a hungry pigeon that needed to eat food, in a box, one of his operant chambers. They later became known as Skinner boxes, even though he didn't like that name. But he put a bird in such a chamber, and it had a food hopper that held grain in it, so the food could be brought next to the wall of the chamber so that the bird could peck at it, and then it could be taken away. So this was the method of reinforcement, that a few seconds access of the grain and the bird would eat, and then the grain would go away, and that would be it. So in this experiment, unbelievably simple experiment, all he did was set up the food on a timer so that the grain was available for eating every 15 seconds, and then it would go away. And the bird had nothing to do. There was nothing that the bird had to do to make the food come, nor could it make the food come any quicker. When the food was there, the bird could eat. So there was no required response in this situation. But what Skinner discovered was that over a period of time, birds would adapt some repeated behavior that they would do. Some of them would peck at the floor by their feet. One would bop its head up and down. another one would turn around in circles in the chamber. And all these behaviors were, one, they were unique to the bird. Different birds had different behaviors. And secondly, they looked as though the bird believed that doing this action brought the food. And so this is why it's called superstition in the pigeon. And Skinner's explanation for it was that there was an accidental relationship between something the bird had done just randomly and the food coming, and that that had made that action, bobbing its head, more frequent. And so as it does it more of it, the likelihood of it happening coincident with the food is increased. And so there you go. And the behavior just continues. So this was thought to be an analogy to human superstition, where something works and we do it again. The problem was that later on, other researchers began to question whether what was being seen in that experiment was what Skinner said it was. Some people suggested that what was happening was that the birds were showing a kind of instinctive behavior, not operant, not conditioned behavior, but an instinctive form of behavior that comes out when food is present. So there was a little controversy in that experiment in the end, but it still was Skinner's most famous experiment. So although there was controversy in Skinner's experiment, other people went on to do the experiment with humans, where the possibility of instincts having an influence was much less. And one of the famous ones was done with Japanese college students back in the 80s. And this is quite a remarkable study. These college students were brought into a room one at a time. They were all tested individually. They were brought into a room where there was a table and a panel behind it. And on the table were three levers. You could manipulate the levers. And then on the panel in front of them, there were two things. There was a counter that counted points, and there was a light that would shine different colors. It would be yellow for a while, and then maybe it would turn to red, and so forth. A single light, square light. So the students were brought into this environment, and they were told to try to get as many points as they could on the counter. What they were not told was that they were basically pigeons in Skinner's superstition experiment, that the points came on the counter irrespective of what they did. The levers on the table sort of cried out to be moved, but they were not connected to the counter in any way. And the light changing its color also was not connected to anything. That just happened irrespective. The points were arranged so they came sort of randomly on a time schedule. And what happened in the experiment that was interesting was that these college students developed superstitions. They would figure out patterns. It was so tempting to pull the levers that they would pull the levers in strange patterns that would end sometimes in a point being given, and they would repeat these patterns over and over again. And sometimes the pattern would seem to fade away and stop working, so they would develop another pattern on the thing. But the experiment did demonstrate superstitions, but one of the participants in the study was a remarkable case, and so I'm actually going to read from the study to give you an example of how powerful the effect of accidental reinforcement can be. So this is the account of what happened with one of the participants in this study. About 5 minutes into the session, a point delivery occurred after she had stopped pulling the lever temporarily and had put her right hand on the lever frame, the box holding the lever. This behavior was followed by a point delivery, after which she climbed on the table and put her right hand to the counter that gave the points. Just as she did so, another point was delivered. Thereafter, she began touching many things in turn, such as the signal light, the screen, a nail on the screen, and the wall. About 10 minutes later, a point was delivered just as she jumped to the floor from the table, and touching was replaced by jumping. After 5 jumps, a point was delivered when she jumped and touched the ceiling with her slipper in her hand. Jumping to touch the ceiling continued repeatedly and was followed by points until she stopped about 25 minutes into the session, perhaps because of fatigue. I think it must have been fatigue. I would have been exhausted. So here's someone who is behaving very much like Skinner's pigeons, and clearly not instinctive behavior in any way. Obviously, the college student was probably trying to figure it out, but it shows the amazing power of coincidence, that the points were given at a certain time, and that stimulated something in her. So there is good evidence that coincidental events can create personal superstitions in humans. There is also, going back to pigeons, though, Skinner did a second experiment that was kind of interesting that showed a different kind of superstition and has some relevance for us in our everyday lives. This was a study that I've called the pigeon with the lucky hat. And in this case, pigeons were put into a chamber, and more like his typical experiments, the pigeons were trained to peck at a little key, a little disc on the wall of the chamber. And this disc had a colored light behind it, and the color of the disc could be changed from time to time. And so these birds were put in the chamber on a very lean schedule of reinforcement. They had to peck a long time before any rewards came, but they did, and they went at it for long periods of time. And Skinner arranged it so that the color of the light would change, but again, it had no connection to the schedule of reinforcement. And so it would change just at random intervals, and it would stay one color for a long time, and then it would change to another color. Usually, I think he used green and blue. So and of course, pigeons have very good vision, and so this was something that they could detect. What happened was that individual birds began to act as though the color of the light was meaningful. And so for one bird, they might peck very rapidly during the green light when it was on, even though it had no effect on whether they were going to get a reward. And another bird might peck rapidly during the blue light. So again, it's as if they thought the color was in some way lucky or a signal that reward was coming. And that is an example of something that is very common in our lives as well. In addition to having a superstitious ritual that you might have learned by trial and error, we also have superstitions that seem to bond to whatever the environment is in which something good happens. It's, for example, the tennis player Bjorn Borg, who won Wimbledon many times, great Swedish tennis player, was extremely superstitious. And he used to do this thing, which is not unique to him, but he used to not shave for the entire 2-week period of the Wimbledon championships, as if, you know, keeping things exactly as they are, not changing his appearance and letting things just go naturally, had some effect. And if you ever recall, he often would be photographed holding up the trophy for Wimbledon with sort of a scruffy beard. Another example that is maybe even closer to the blue and green light case is that, according to legend, the great basketball player Michael Jordan used to wear a pair of North Carolina shorts underneath his Chicago Bulls shorts. The idea being that those North Carolina shorts had been lucky for him, and he wanted to keep them on, but of course he had to wear his actual uniform over the top. And so there is this sense in which the good events get bonded to the color of a light or to some object that we have in the environment when we do well. And that's a common form of superstition too, usually a personal superstition. So now that we have a superstition, now that we've picked one up, if we have, the next question is, how do we maintain them? Why do they persist? Some people have the same superstition for years and years and years. It's unique to them, but they keep it. If there is no magic, you know, then why do we keep doing it? And the same could be true, really, whether we've acquired it through learning it from others, a socially shared superstition, or an individual one. It seems like they should fade. Well, we move from behavioral psychology and conditioning to cognitive psychology in order to answer that question. And so many of the methods of thinking that we employ tend to act to maintain superstitions once they've been acquired. And that this is true for both socially shared superstitions and personal superstitions. So one of the main concepts that we can apply in this context is confirmation bias. This is a term that has become well-known popularly, so you may have heard of it before. It is a sort of self-preserving bias in the sense that it confirms your prior beliefs. It is something that is very, very common in political reasoning and political discourse, in that two people of opposing political viewpoints can see the same event and they can find that it somehow confirms their beliefs. They pick out the parts of it that seem to be consistent with their viewpoint, and they ignore the aspects that aren't. And yet, an opposite person can do the same thing, picking out different aspects of the event. So the result of that is that our views are maintained, that we don't have our own prejudices challenged in any way. And it's a common and very human phenomenon. So what's interesting about it in terms of cognitive psychology and how it's been studied is that confirmation bias affects many aspects of our interaction with ideas. So, for example, there have been experiments in which they proposed a hypothesis, just a random hypothesis, about a person, and that person is asked to interview another person and with this hypothesis about them in mind. And what was discovered was that people tend to ask questions that confirm that hypothesis. There could have been other questions that could be asked that would have led to a different answer, but confirmation bias colors the actual inquiry that you make into the situation, the kinds of questions you ask. It also, of course, affects the way you see the data. You see it in relation to your own beliefs, and it colors your evaluation of the data. It also can color what you remember. So again, the same event can be remembered differently by different people, or more likely, you will recall those events that confirm your own beliefs to begin with, and you'll easily forget the ones that don't. And so confirmation bias is an extremely powerful effect, and it happens in a number of cases. One of the most interesting ways in which it can apply is in the case of a psychic reading. If you go to see a psychic, it's often the case that both people involved want this thing to work. The you wouldn't pay money to see a psychic in most cases unless you believe that there was some value in that activity. And of course, the psychic has an interest in being accurate as well. So if you go to a psychic or an astrologer or a fortune teller, they are going to try to pick up on things. It's a technique called cold reading, where they pick up on cues that you give them. And if you're interested in it working, you may help them out. You may, in fact, you know, a psychic may say something like, you've experienced a recent disappointment. Okay, well, I'm sure in most people's lives, if they thought about it enough, they could come up with something that would fit that. And so what happens often is that the sitter, the person who's come for the reading, and the psychic become collaborators in this effort of making it work, and they help each other out. Often the customer will provide cues unconsciously that the psychic can pick up on. So in that situation, both both people are involved in a kind of process of confirming their beliefs. I can give you another example from a famous baseball player who had many superstitions, and one of my favorite characters in the topic of superstition. And this is Wade Boggs. Wade Boggs played third base for the Red Sox, the Yankees, and the Rays during his career, which was between 1982 and 1999. Wade Boggs was a five-time American League batting champion. He was a very good hitter. He played third base, and he twice got the Golden Glove, and he was elected to the Hall of Fame in 2005. So he was a very good player. But he was also perhaps the most superstitious player ever, at least one of the most superstitious players ever. He had a several hours long ritual that he would do each time he prepared for a game, and it involved never stepping on the foul line when you entered the field, but always stepping on it when you left the field, and all sorts of different aspects that he had to tick off in his ritual before a game. But Wade Boggs was most famous for a very unusual superstition, which was that he believed that eating chicken helped him hit. He was, in fact, known as Chicken Man as a nickname. And he and his wife, he got to be so good at chicken, and his wife also at making it, that the two of them put out a chicken cookbook of chicken recipes called Foul Tips, little pun in the title. So he ate chicken before every game. And this superstition began when he was playing baseball in high school, and he just happened to have a chicken meal before the game. And he got a hit every single time he came to bat that game, which, as you know, would be unusual given its 30% chance of getting hit and getting a hit in most cases. So he got a hit 4 for 4 in that game. And from that point on, he never turned back. He started eating chicken before every single game, and he did so throughout his entire professional career. So this is an interesting case of a confirmation bias situation, in the sense that he believed that chicken helped him hit, and of course he was a very good hitter. So that's a situation that's likely to promote superstition. It turns out that the studies that have been done show that actually the better athletes are more likely to be superstitious than the bench players who are not the best athletes. On the one hand, you know, once you're first string, you've got a lot to lose if you don't perform well. But on the other hand, and so if you're doing well, then your superstitions also seem to work. So both having a lot at stake and having the illusion that the superstitions are working would maintain them. And that all applied to Wade Boggs as well. But the thing is that he never didn't eat chicken. All he concentrated on was the situation of having eaten chicken and getting a hit. And sometimes he didn't get a hit, even though he'd eaten chicken. But what he never did was to stop eating chicken for a while to see whether that would affect his performance. It probably would, simply by, you know, anxiety. But the point of my story is that we don't really have any solid evidence that chicken helped him hit or not. All we know is that he was correlated with chicken. We don't know whether his eating chicken was correlated with getting a hit. And so this is a kind of confirmation bias. Finally, another thing that we should recognize as something that helps to maintain superstition is a phenomenon known as the illusion of control. And so even when there's no skill involved in an activity, if you do something positive, a ritual, or engage in a superstition, it can help you in the sense of giving you the sense that you're doing better and giving you the illusion that you have control over the events. The simplest way to explain that is with an experiment that was conducted, a classic experiment, in which they brought two people into the lab, and it was an experiment in psychokinesis. They were, which is mind over matter. They're going to test these people and see if they had any ability to control the roll of a dice, a single die. And so the setup was that the die would be rolled by one of the two people into a funnel so that how it landed was hidden from them. They didn't want the participants, as they did this over and over again, to be affected by their success in any way. So they revealed later what the results were. But one person rolled a die, and the other person just simply sat there and tried to have influence over it. And what the study showed was that the person rolling the die felt as though they had greater confidence in their ability to predict what the outcome would be than the person who merely sat and watched. And of course, the reality is neither one of them had any control over the outcome. It is a totally random activity, but the activity of rolling, the fact that the person was making some effort involved and had some involvement in the activity gave him an illusion of control. And so many superstitions have that aspect to them, that they may be sustained by a sort of false psychological feeling that you have control over a situation that is inherently uncontrollable. And that may be enough to maintain many superstitions.